I think what one of the biggest goals for an artist is to have your audience to disarm all of their defenses and get into their subconscious, into their psyche, into their heart. People, for some reason, I think, tend to let that happen more. Their defenses are lowered when they see film on a subconscious level because it's organic. You trust it in some way. And I think you're more likely to get immersed in a story.
Welcome back to another episode of the iFilmmaker Podcast. I am your host, Ariel Martinez. And on this episode, I have my friend Joel Famularo. He is the creator of the Phantom LUTs, the famous Phantom LUTs that I've been using for basically 90% of my work for several years now. Joel is an incredibly talented colorist, editor, shooter, DP, cinematographer, director. Super, super talented. And we get pretty deep on this episode. Joel shares reveals, and I didn't even know this, he's only been doing this for 3 to 4 years, and the level of his creativity, the level of his work is incredible. And I was in awe when I found this out, because he just shows how his pure passion was able to drive his talent and therefore his success. This was incredible. So we get pretty deep. This is probably the deepest I've ever gone in it on any of my episodes. We get pretty down to the nitty gritty of his passion, and it was pretty incredible, you know, what we were able to talk about, what Joel shared with us. So we get into that. It was very inspiring, and I just loved enjoying the conversation with him. We even spoke after we stopped recording. We spoke for like a whole nother hour, just because he's such a great guy to talk to. And just to be in that sort of atmosphere where passion and passion are talking, it was just so awesome. It was so incredible. But we have a great conversation here. We talk about his Phantom LUTs. We talk about many, many things, including the Sony a7S III. Like, we get into all that stuff. So before we get into our conversation with Joel, I just want to remind you guys, if you haven't already done so, go and follow us, follow our Facebook group, join our Facebook group. We have a lot of fun there, guys. We're posting announcements there all the time with these episodes. And also, if you haven't already done so, also go check out Jackson Kingsley's Video Mastery Seminar. It's a 40 minutes of free information. It's great information where he's sharing his top 10 secrets to video business success. It's free. So go and check that out with the link in the description for this episode. Make sure that you're sharing these episodes. If you find value in them, make sure that you're sharing it with your buddies, anybody that you think would be of benefit to listen to any of these episodes. So I don't want to take any more time, because we do have a nice long conversation with Joel. So with all that out of the way, let's go ahead and get into our conversation with Joel Famularo. Joel Famularo, thank you for coming on the iFilmmaker Podcast.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
Super excited to have you, man. Let's go ahead and just get started with getting to know who Joel is, what it is that you do, yeah, how you get started, you know, sort of, yeah, your journey there.
Yeah, sure. I first started making films when I was 15, I think, even 14. It's a long story short. I'll try keep it short. But we had some family friends who would make films with little, you know, digital sort of, or not even digital, but a little tape camera, Hi8 camera. And they'd film, say, someone running into a door, closing the door, and then they'd cut, and then they'd start filming again with the door closing from the inside, and then running up the stairs, and then they'd cut. And so they were kind of editing in camera, and it was the first time I'd ever seen somebody make a sequential kind of narrative. And it was clunky because there'd be sort of like a little gap between each cut, you know, where maybe they'd cut too late or whatever. And then the next shot would pick up with them standing there and then running again. But me and my brothers were just like, whoa, that's so cool. Like, it was so fun. And we were sort of, there wasn't a lot to do in this town where we were visiting these friends of ours. So we started doing it. We started making films, and they were just funny, stupid films. We'd show our parents, and but you know, they were fun and a good way to pass the time. But I really got obsessed with it, and I really seemed to have a knack for it. And I'd always been artistic. Like, I'd played music, I played bass guitar, and I used to draw a lot, and I used to make things out of plasticine, you know, and clay. Like, I used to, like, when I was a kid, I saw Jurassic Park, and I used to make, like, you know, dinosaurs out of plasticine with, like, white teeth and red eyes, and I was really always into the detail. But this was a new thing to discover, and it just kind of came naturally to me. Anyway, so then I went into grade 10 at school, and I think it was the first year my school, or the second year or something, that they were offering film and TV as a class. So I took it and basically topped the class. Like, I became the film and TV kid. I won a couple of festivals. You know, there was like a regional festival at the end of year 12 from my sort of town up a few hundred kilometers in my state. It was kind of like this region where all of these high schools could enter, and I won this festival, and it just really was coming naturally to me. But then after I left high school, I quit because I was in a small town, and I went to study it at what we have. It's called TAFE here. I don't know if you guys have TAFE in America, but it's kind of,
not sure I recognize
it's that. Not, yeah, it's not, it's kind of like trade school, I think you guys call okay. it. Yeah, I think from memory, that's what you guys call it. So it's not university, but it is sort of in between, you know, high school and university. Anyway, I went to study film, and it was a production course. It was all they had, was basically teaching how to be a producer, and I am not a producer. So I got 6 months through that and sort of lost interest and didn't really have a team or a crew. And then I sort of put down the camera. I was about 18. You know, I mean, I was still going well those first 6 months. We won another festival and with the film we made. But then I kind of didn't have, it just wasn't working out. So I put the camera down from 18 and then didn't pick it up again until I was about 29.
oh, wow.
Yeah, I went and did acting, back into music. I started two bands. I was really pursuing other artistic kind of avenues, and
wow,
yeah, and that's a whole story in itself. But I couldn't make it work, you know. When I got reached around 30, it's like I'm married and my wife wanted to have a kid, and I was probably not, I would have been ambivalent about it. I would have been like, yeah, maybe, we'll see. But she did, and so I was like, okay, well, I'm not gonna, you know, deny her that. So I had to start thinking, how am I gonna make money? And my band was not making any money. My acting was right, making a bit of money, but it's just, you're sitting around as an actor waiting for a call. It's just not any way to have a, you know, a serious career. So I broke up my band at around, yeah, I was 29, 30, and didn't know what the hell I was going to do. I was willing to go back and sell cars. Not go back and sell cars. I'd never sold them before, but I had done a bit of sales when I was younger. And so I was considering going back into sales and, you know, giving up the whole artist thing, which was a pretty big deal for me because, like I said, I grew up in an artistic family, and I'd been making things since I was, you know, could remember, always making things, and didn't really know what to do. Started to feel like a bit of a loser, really. Started to think maybe, you know, this isn't going to work out. Like, I'm not gonna...
And this is at 30 years old,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I just turned 34 the other day. So this is, things are about to turn around. So at about 30, 31, I remembered I always loved being on set because I had been acting, like I said, through my 20s, and I was like, I always love being on set. It's kind of my favorite place to be. And pretty quickly I realized, well, why don't I, you know, I had a few friends who had crossed over from acting into directing or acting into being DPs, and I always remembered I had a good eye, you know, and so, or at least I'd been told that by my art teacher and by various people. So I was like, well, you know, maybe it'd be worth picking up the camera again, seeing what happens. So I started showing up on set, just getting coffees, just helping as a production assistant. And I was about, you know, about 3-4 years ago. And pretty quickly, I got a little A7S. And then, you know, cut a very long story short, 3.5 years later, I've got an Amira, an FS7, a Pocket 4K, and I just pre-ordered an A7S III. So it's something happened, something clicked, and that's how I find myself here today.
doesn't it make you think, what if you've been doing this the entire time?
Yeah. But yeah, it does, because if I had stuck with it when I was 18 and never left, I mean, I couldn't do it where I was living up north in Australia. There was no infrastructure, no industry. But yeah, I mean, who knows where I'd be now if I never gave it up.
Right.
But also, I learned so much through my 20s doing, you know, I led a band, I learned leadership, I learned...
That's good.
I learned a lot of things. It wasn't wasted. And I'm actually, yeah, I'm making up for lost time. I'm very busy.
So that's incredible. I did not know that you've only been doing this for a few years, technically.
Yeah, it's hard to explain to people, but yeah, technically,
How have you moved up so fast? Like,
I guess...
How are you getting... I mean, what is it that you're doing right now? Or what did you do a couple of years ago that started getting people to trust you with their money, with their work?
Yeah.
What were you showing them?
Yeah, I don't tend to tell people. It's kind of funny I'm announcing this on this podcast. It's not a bad look, but I'm, you know, yeah, it kind of... You don't want, you know what it's like. You want people to trust you, exactly like you just said.
Yeah.
You want people
to, of course.
That perception matters. I guess I've always, like, even through my 20s, I always had such a strong opinion on film. Like, I would always write Facebook statuses about films, and they'd be very in-depth, and people would, I'd get in these big debates, and I always knew film was always my passion. I just kind of, music's my passion too, and you know, other things, but really, I always deep down knew film was the thing. Like, when I first started directing, when I was, like, seriously in high school, when I was 15, 16, I had never, and to this day, I've never, you know, I've got a few skills and a few things that I've developed, skill sets, but I've never done anything like that comes more naturally to me than directing. And back then, you know, I was a director DP, obviously I didn't know the distinction between them, but just my communication, mm-hmm. like my personality, I'm kind of passionate about leadership. Like, I actually read books on it. Like, I love leading teams. So, it's just kind of this confluence of my personality. So when I, you know, at 30, I don't know, I guess I'd always paid attention to films. I think I know how to present and communicate. And I guess I just picked it up pretty quick. Like, I just started sort of, I'd never really done photography. So that was my weakest thing, was understanding framing and lensing. Mm-hmm. The thing is I say this to people, I picked up lighting very fast. And I think the reason is because decades of drawing. I used to draw in my teen years, obsessively. Like, I used to draw Dragon Ball Z figures. I used to draw all sorts of things through my
kids. I love Dragon Ball Z.
Oh, dude.
That was my thing back in the day.
Me too, man. So I used to draw them and even sell them at high school. People would pay me they'd commission me like $20, $50 to draw them Goku or Vegeta, like high detail. So I could draw them, like, you know, I at one point I considered, man, maybe I want to be an anime artist. Like, I used to be that heavily into it. So lighting and shading was something, again, that had been deposited in my subconscious, I guess, 15 years ago. So when I started shooting, very quickly I was like, I don't like the look of that. And then it was just an issue. Then it was just the challenge of learning the skill set, which is just any skill set you can learn on YouTube. You can learn talking to friends. But I guess having that eye was something that I developed a long time ago. And I guess I just kept shooting. I just realized the power of making high quality stuff will get you work. People will start seeking you out. And I guess I've just constantly been making stuff. Yeah.
So it seems like, I mean, for the longest time, you've always had that creative eye. You've always had that creative passion.
Mm.
And whether you know it or not, it added to your career now. Like,
totally.
Even though you weren't shooting back then, you were still developing the muscles that you needed, the creative muscles that you needed for your career now.
Yeah, it would appear that way.
No, I mean, it makes perfect sense, because how else do you explain kind of where you are now in such a short amount of time?
Mm.
Now, when you get your jobs, clients always want to know what it is that you do, the work that you've done, you know? Are you showing them passion projects back then when you were first starting?
Yeah.
Are you showing them like a director's treatment?
Typically, even now my reel is made up of a large percentage of passion projects or stuff that I did for discounted rates. And, you know, I think, you know, another thing actually, I think it is kind of an advantage of being in my 30s and having all this life experience. Mm-hmm. A lot of the ways I pay the bills are doing things that will never end up on my reel or never end up on my Instagram. So,
oh yeah, I think people don't admit that as much as they,
yeah.
I believe that's the case for just about everybody.
It is.
Most of the work that we do does not end up on social media or whatnot. It's just because it's not glorified. It's not a lot creative work. But yeah. Anyways, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, no, it's just I think that I've been producers have told me that I know how to make people feel comfortable. So if they send me out on a shoot, like, at, you know, shooting interviews and B-roll, just a basic corporate shoot, mm-hmm. or like a little mini documentary, I'll show up. I'm polite. I show up on time. I've got enough life experience. I've done enough things to be, they can trust me. So I think that's a big part of it as well. Is if I was 21, I wouldn't know how to handle those situations as well as now being 34. I know how the world works. You know, I show up and I make people, you know, often people say, oh, Joel made me feel comfortable. And then, so the interview's better and he sort of could make a joke and put me at ease. So, you know, I guess having that's where age has actually been a help. I think that you sort of just have that already in the bag. You know how to present yourself. So, and again, that is how I got to where I am more and more working on better looking stuff was working on bad looking stuff and then just generating good images and you know, myself, like going out and directing or finding a director or finding a producer and getting projects off the ground that then I'll put that on my reel and that on my Instagram and then that, you know, yeah,
that's good. Man, that's incredible to hear that. It seems like your passion is really what drove your career in the beginning and got you started. This is where I tell people, the first and foremost thing that you should have for a career like this is passion. Yeah. Because I think that your desire for money is only going to take you so far. Totally. The passion is what's going to make you do these passion projects, things that people are not paying you for.
Yeah.
But you're going to want to do them and do them good.
Yeah.
And that's what you want to show off to your clients. That's what my passion projects get me, not only the most jobs, but the bigger jobs too.
True.
And those are the jobs that, I mean, because that's what I love to do. And it seems like that's the case with you. You're just at a whole nother level where you were just able to find those clients and get them to trust you with the passion projects, just with your own passion.
Yeah.
That's actually quite incredible.
Thanks, man.
And congratulations for that, man. Really, I did not know that you've been doing this for a few years. I thought you're like a veteran in this whole. I really did, because I'm using the LUTs that you make, the Phantom LUTs. And I mentioned that in the introduction, but I'm using your Phantom LUTs. I'm like, man, this guy knows what he's talking about, you know? And I watched your entire promotional video for those Phantom LUTs. Very articulate, very informative, something that only veterans talk about, you know? And I'm like, this is some great stuff.
I'll tell you another interesting thing that I've been thinking about. I've learned, I would even go as far to say I've mastered a few skills. And I'll tell you what, the more you do, the faster you get at it. So taught myself how to draw, but you know, which is like, cool, whatever. Like, but I mean, I obsessively was into it as a child and teenager. That was my first real passion. And then I taught myself filmmaking. I wouldn't say I mastered that, because I only did it for about 3 years before I hung it up, but I did learn a lot in a short amount of time. Then I'd played music in my life, but I'd never written a song, I never sang. So then I started a band, I started writing songs and singing. And then I didn't have, just the way my brain works, like I had to start, I had it spilled over into not just writing songs, but producing them. So I would record them, and then I started using drum machines because I could conceive of the drum beat, but I didn't have enough microphones to record. And I didn't have the skill to actually play the drums, but I could hear it in my head. So I started programming drums, and then I got better and better and better at that. Then I, by the end of my band, I was a songwriter, and I would write all the instruments and teach my band their parts. I would, you know, and all their vocal parts. And I was a producer, and then I would mix it as well. Just because I had no money, I couldn't afford to pay anyone else to do it. And I, you know, I knew what I wanted. So I just taught myself on YouTube or on by just the school of hard knocks, just by trying different things, experimenting. And what I noticed was there would be parallels between, it sounds weird and it's hard to even explain, but there's parallels between stuff you learn in drawing. More about human perception, like you go to copy something as a drawing and you think, oh, that line is a straight line, and then you draw it straight, and then you look at the picture and you go, actually, it looks straight perceptually, but it's not straight. It's kind of an illusion.
Right.
And then you learn how to actually, you know, depict and render things that actually look real. And it's often counterintuitive when you actually go to do it. Like your eye sees one thing, your brain interprets it one way, and then you go to do it and it's not what you think it is. So it's the same with, and then it's like the same with audio. Like you think that sounds rich. I know how to make it sound rich. I'll do this. And then you go, no, actually that makes it sound poxy. So what's the secret to making something sound rich? And then there's all this, it always gets more and more complex the more you get into it. So then when I started making these LUTs, when I started teaching myself lighting, when I started doing all this stuff, I had this confidence in my perception. Like I had this confidence in all of these different skills that I'd learned. And there was all of these parallel kind of concepts that were already in my brain from all these other things that I had spent thousands, tens of thousands of hours doing. It doesn't hurt that I have an obsessive personality.
That only helps.
It only helps. So I just found everything I learned. So yeah, I've been learning color grading to make these LUTs. And again, it's always out of necessity. I didn't make the LUTs to make money or to even sell them. I made LUTs because I needed S-Log LUTs because S-Log was a pain in the ass. And I didn't. sorry. Yeah. I couldn't believe there wasn't a solution for it. So I'm like, well, I'll make it myself. And then I started posting images online and people in the groups like, how'd you get that look? How'd you get those colors? And then I said, oh, I made the LUT. And then it just evolved from there. But it's like I've spent the last 2-3 years just tweaking in DaVinci and just, I don't know. Yeah. So I guess the point of that is the reason I brought that up is just like when you learn things, it gets that little bit quicker to learn the next thing. And then a little bit, because everything's kind of, the universe is kind of, it boils down to basic principles in a sense. Like, you know, if you look at physics, if you look at all of these things, the universe kind of, there's a lot of parallels in different kind of, you know, the way that light works, the way that sound works, the spectrum, the way we perceive it, yada yada. So
yeah,
it's culminating in, you know, I'm so excited right now, like that you asked me to do this podcast, because I'm about 70% of the way through this next generation of LUTs. I'm doing these film LUTs, and they're kind of my best yet. Like everything I've learned is being like deposited into these, and I'm in the middle of it. And I've been talking a lot to Julian Jarry. He's been sort of testing them for me and giving me his feedback, and we've been talking a fair bit, and he's been a great help actually, just as a sounding board and just as someone for me to show some of this test footage to and go, am I crazy or does that look awesome? Does that look like film? And he's like, no, dude, it does. It looks like...
It's always good to get a little bit of feedback from some people that know what they're talking about as well. Also just to get fresh eyes on it too, because you've been you've been coloring this stuff, and it's all kind of... I know what it feels like to work on something, whether it's audio or visuals, coloring. And it starts all to just kind of mush together, and you just need a break. You need to step out, or somebody has to see it with fresh eyes to give you the
exactly. And
feedback.
I'm so excited, and I'm showing my. And you know, I'm in lockdown here in Australia, in Melbourne. We are literally in stage 4 lockdown right now. So it's kind of good because I'm having a ball. Like I'm having a ton of. I've got so much time to just go deep. My wife hasn't seen me in months. She's seeing me, but. I show her the test footage, or I show her the LUTs, and she's like, yeah, it looks good. I'm like, oh, babe, don't you see? Like, and I'm trying to explain it to her. And I'm like, oh, I need to show. I gotta get these out. And I think that's the artistic impulse. Actually, you talked about passion. I think that's what an artist. Like, there's a lot of talk about what art is and what motivates artists. For me, I thought about this when I was 30 and I was about to give up art. I was like, what is it in the first place? And it's like, it's just you see beauty, you cultivate beauty, you create beauty, and then you want to share it with people. Because you, the experience of discovering something beautiful or creating something beautiful, if you're lucky, is, you know, that feeling you look at something beautiful, it's just mm-hmm. like, oh, it's the best thing in the world. Beauty is what makes the world go round. And the first thing you want to do is go, hey, come look at this. Hey, come look at this. You know, that's what we do as cinematographers. You know, we walk past a flower, 100 people walk past it and miss it. We want to take a photo, but we want to film it. And then people go, oh, I didn't notice that. Thanks for pointing that out. Mm-hmm. It's always been there, but we just highlight it.
Yep.
And I think that's what it's kind of like when you make food for someone. You're like, hey, I got this recipe. I make these awesome nachos or I make these awesome burgers.
Yep.
I want you to try them.
Yeah, that happens all the time when the sun is at the perfect place and you see some totally. You see some light streaks coming in through a window, creating a beautiful pattern on that wall. light seeping in through, you know, you have some foreground there and you're thinking, man, this just a shot right here, it's gonna look so nice. And you appreciate things like that.
I think that's what being an artist is, that sensitivity to beauty. And it's kind of our role on the earth. I think, yeah,
man, I think that in the, how do I put this, in the, We're talking in the realm of passion, right? Mm, we're talking in a realm of passion. This is what drives us, really. Because if money was to drive us, we would have quit a long time ago, right? Totally. It's the passion that's going to keep us going when there is no money, when there's really no logical or reasonable purpose to continue doing what you're doing. Passion is what continues pushing you forward to do it.
Yeah.
Right? But I think in the, what you're talking about, you know, that looking at the light, looking at the beauty of things, you know, I would translate that to sort of attention to detail.
Yeah.
You know, in the logical sense, and the, you know, anybody that doesn't do what we do, they're going to say, wow, you notice a lot of things. You have a lot of attention to those kinds of details. But for us, it's just the passion of loving what you're doing. You're loving it so much that you don't want to stop searching it. You want to keep looking at it, and you want to find better ways to create that. And so that's what's going to drive you to continue on YouTube and see what other people are doing and learn from other people. I think that that's just beautiful. That's beautiful. That's really, really, I mean, I think we could end the episode right here and it would be a fantastic episode.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
But that's fantastic,
this is fun. Let's keep talking.
No, this is so much fun. So, I mean, I want to get into the, I guess, the color.
Sure.
Your approach to color, your approach, your philosophy, if you will, with color. How do you and I know this, it's to me, just thinking about it, it's like, how do you describe verbally your approach to color?
Well, it's funny because that's exactly what I'm writing this script right now. I'm probably a quarter of the way through. I've got the intro down. I'll actually send it to you after this, just a private link. It'd be good to get your feedback on just the first kind of 2 minutes of the new video. But the way I describe it, I've been thinking a lot about this. It's the first thing people notice is the color. But when you, again, when you get into it, it's amazing how much impact other things have on the color, like the specific contrast curve, the way, specifically with what I'm doing now, but even if this pertains to the Alexa LUTs, because the Alexa is also very filmic, so there are certain crossovers. But the way that film or Alexa saturates, you know, if you look into the concept of subtractive color, it's essentially the idea that as you get closer to white in the tonality, the saturation starts to diminish a bit. So when you get to white, you know, 99% light gray is basically fully desaturated. That's kind of the, that's how highlight roll off works. You sort of lose contrast increasingly as you reach white and you lose saturation. So those things like principles like that, and I'm going to talk about that in this new video, the way the shadows saturate, the way the mid saturate, it's really the philosophy. Really what I'm chasing is, I've realized this recently, is an organic feel to the footage. Like, I have this theory that it's not probably an original theory, but it's just the way I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people were innately attracted to organic chemical processes. So I think there's a reason people love listening to records, or a lot of music producers love using valve amps instead of digital amps. Like, there's something about the closer you can get to nature, I think people have this kind of, and more than ever in 2020, you know, because it's a technologically accelerating, increasingly synthetic age where, you know, we've got deep fakes. I was just listening to this podcast yesterday about deep fakes where they can frame people. AI is so advanced.
Yeah, I've seen some of that. You can actually
frame people. Yeah. And so we're living in this age where, can we trust our perception anymore when we, you know, people can, you know, the AI can mimic voices, it can mimic faces, and well, everything's digital. We're moving away from analog. So I think, why do we, film won't die, okay? And records, vinyl records won't die. These valve amps, they're not dying. If anything, they're gaining in popularity, counterintuitively. And I think the reason is because, well, specifically when it comes to art, especially, I think what one of the biggest goals for an artist is to have your audience to disarm all of their defenses and get into their subconscious, into their psyche, into their heart. And people, for some reason, I think, tend to let that happen more. Their defenses are lowered when they see film on a subconscious level because it's organic. You trust it in some way. And I think you're more likely to get immersed in a story. I mean, that's not a hard and fast rule, but to illustrate the kind of logic of it, think about an extreme example. So let's say you showed your short film, you shot it on film, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then you shot the exact same short film on infrared camera. Like, could you get any more digital, any further removed from an organic process? No, it's going to be a little distracting. People are going to be like, dude, I can't focus. Why is it all infrared? Why does it look like Predator? And it's like, don't worry about that. Just focus on the story. It's like, yeah, but the medium you've used to communicate this is so far removed from my perception that I'm just distracted by it. And I think that's the other thing. Film is chemical and organic. Our eyes are chemical and organic. We see the world, we don't see it in a linear, like, we don't see the world in a linear way. If you look under your desk, or if you look into a dark room, you know, next time you're walking down your hallway, look into a dark place and you can see the way your eyes fall off into black. You never really see full black. It's always, your eyes are always fighting to kind of pull detail out of the blacks. So you kind of see very dark gray.
Yeah, you notice it. You notice it at night when you turn off the lights and it's pitch black, but wait a few minutes and you'll start seeing more detail.
But you'll see, even when you see into the dark, it's in lower contrast. Like, you're not seeing one stop of difference in kind of a well-lit area will be a lot more distinct than a stop of difference in a dark room. So your eyes have fall off like film, okay? Your eyes have roll off like film as well. When you're looking at a bright area, if you're, you know, at that point where your eyes almost can't take it and you're squinting, you see less and less detail. So your eyes have fall off like film and roll off like film. And so I think that's why we trust film. That's what it is. That's kind of the psychological mystery. Because I think all art is playing, the canvas of all art, of any art form, is the human psyche or heart. Like, that's what the art is affecting. So if you know that, you can tailor it to a human being in various ways to make it a little bit more instantly kind of appealing, sort of like shooting something into your veins instead of drinking it. You know, if you need a drug, adrenaline, shoot it in instead of sort of take it in a pill, let your stomach break it down. The less impedance, the better. So that's kind of my that's kind of the guiding principle, is this idea of really chasing those things that make something feel organic and feel true to life. Does that make sense? I know that's a very
answer. Definitely, it's incredibly deep. I don't think I could have described that the way that you just did, but I totally get it. I think that, I mean, technology is amazing. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
But even then, there's a reason why I think most cinematographers prefer natural light. There's something about natural light that brings out the beautiful organic colors in skin tones and everything.
Yeah.
And it's really, really difficult to emulate natural light.
Yeah.
You know, very, very hard. Even with technology, as advanced as technology is, it's really hard.
But it's like you said, it's the most beautiful for some reason, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the interesting part.
That's why there's a huge difference between, you know, acoustic guitar and electric guitar. There's a huge difference there. And like you said, there's something about listening to a vinyl record.
Mm.
Like, if somebody was to create a vinyl, I mean, if you were to listen to a real vinyl record and then somebody was to get a real song digitally created and try to emulate a vinyl record, I'm no expert, but I'm willing to bet that people that know about that stuff would be able to tell the difference.
Yeah.
I think
and that...
Huh?
Yeah. Well, no, it's just because there's two questions. There's, can it be done?
Right.
But the deeper question is that I'm interested in is, as well, I am interested in the first question, but the deeper question is, why do we want to do it? And
right.
Because some people think, who cares about film? Who cares about vinyl? Move on.
Right.
But it's clearly not going away, and I'm like, what is it? And I think it's that we trust it. It just gets in. It's that, it's like intravenous. It goes straight in, just a little bit easier, because we resonate. Like, it's like some weird we and again, our brain's detecting this in subtleties we can't even explain. It's so, our brain's so fast at identifying fake and reality, truth and lies, fake, you know, which is also, you can expand that to the world in general. Like, I feel like it's so much harder to find truth these days. And step away from art for a second.
Yeah.
With technology, it's making it so hard to know what to think or feel or believe and where to come down on, you know. And I don't want to get into that because it's such a crazy time right now. But that, again, I think that actually feeds into why people trust these processes, these organic processes. So I guess I'm defending the argument in my own mind, going, well, is it worth pursuing this look? And I'm like, yeah, I think it is, because there's a real deep comfort that we have in these sort of chemical processes. And it's and as a filmmaker, the more that I can disarm my audience, the better. That's how I see it.
That's so good. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, the same rule applies to even food. People want organic food.
Exactly.
And, you know, I think companies, the trick for companies, and it's funny because this applies to us, but the trick for companies is, how can I get the healthiest, most organic food?
Yeah.
But not have to pay so much to create it, because then I'm going to have to charge our customers a lot of money.
Yeah.
So they're constantly experimenting how to get as organic as possible.
Yeah.
Without spending too much money. And then the same thing for us, because, you know, the reason why we don't use, like, people are going, like, we're shifting everything to LED lights now, it's because, you know, we have these tungsten lights that are incredibly hot. They're not very efficient with electricity, but they produce the most accurate colors.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an efficiency type of deal, you know. Mm. So now companies are trying to say, okay, how can we make a better, you know, a product that would look just like that, but you don't have to use that much electricity. It's not as hot, right?
Yeah.
Constantly, you see all the time, people are trying to come out with these film LUTs, right? Yeah. Like, what I mean, like, turn, make your footage look like 16 millimeter film, Yeah. So, yeah. And we could tell the difference. You could tell that that's not the 16 millimeter film.
Yeah. And I understand that bias. Like sometimes people, less now because I think a lot of the people have seen the amount of effort I put into them. But at the beginning, when I first started making the LUTs, obviously, like it started with people asking me, but then pretty quickly people were like, oh, they're pretty cynical about it. Oh, more LUTs, great, just what we need. And I'm like, well, don't use them then. But I'm putting a lot of effort. I'm not just kind of, you know, another thing I try to do is make sure the LUTs work in every conceivable situation. So I've got like 10 hours of footage. I go through like this gamut. I put the LUTs through. I'm like always checking.
Man, I got to tell you, man, you have given my FS7 new purpose. Just
wait till you throw these new LUTs, dude. Seriously.
Oh, man, I'm so excited because, honestly, like I look at my FS7 and I recently put out a video and you and I were talking about it. I like the FS7, the efficiency of it, but it's just something about the quality, the color quality out of that camera that just wasn't jiving with me. You know, there was just something, like we said, unnatural about this, you know, to me. And I think that, people say Canon colors are the best. But I think it's just, you know, trying to achieve that natural color, at least as a starting point, is what people are looking for. And Sony was way far away from that. But your LUTs have really, like, with the click of a button, I'm able to just apply that and it really gets me there. And that's what has impressed me with the Phantom LUTs from the G9s, I think, is what I started with, and then the G10s.
Yeah.
Which were even better. And I'm like, man, these skin tones are looking really, really good. So that's what I'm using now. But you're working on some new ones now.
Yeah, yeah. So this is when I released the Gen 10s for the Alexa LUTs in January, I mentioned I'm going to try to update and complete from Generation 9 to Generation 10 the new film LUTs. But I didn't really have a clear vision or an idea of what I wanted to do. So I've been doing various other things, but now I've got all this time. I thought, well, why don't I actually just do that? I thought I could knock it out in a week or two, and then it's turned out to be 6 weeks because, I've found a new goal for them. And essentially, here's the basic elevator pitch. Here's what the new LUTs are all about. So in the past, I've just learned more. And in the past, I just had 5 looks. I called them Film Look 1. 2, 3, 4, 5. Whereas the Alexa LUTs have names like, you know, Ice Blue, Neutral, Utopia, Jamaica, and Tungsten. So they had names. Yeah. The film looks never. I always felt a little bit like, oh, I stand behind them. I like them, but my favorite with the Alexa. And I noticed that I stopped using the film LUTs on my own projects. I would just always use the Alexa LUTs, and I wasn't happy about that because I didn't want the idea of people paying for them. And it's like, well, if I'm not using them, if I don't believe in them, I need to update them. But people would write to me saying, you know, they liked them and stuff. So I was like, I don't know if I should, you know, just put that much time into it. But then I realized I've just been watching a lot of movies in through COVID, and there really is something different about film. Like I went back, I kind of got to the point where I thought, oh, film and Alexa, it's basically, they're the same now. It's over. Who cares about film? Like apart from the fact that they've got some quirky colors and they've got this and that. Then I started watching films again, like, and I was like, no, there really is something still. There's something about film that is special. And so I started just watching films and just looking really hard, just squinting, just kind of going, what is the difference? And I think I figured it out. And it was a couple of epiphanies, but the most recent and exciting one is probably a week and a half ago. I just kind of, and I spoke to Julie and I'm like, dude, I figured it out. It's there. And so, then I got really excited and you know, now what I'm doing also is I'm making them for the Arri because I own a mirror. I'm making them for the Blackmagic Pocket 4K and now the Sony. So 3 cameras now. So this video for the first time is going to include footage from all 3 cameras. The LUTs work for all of them, like there are 3 different kinds of LUTs, but they're available for all. Nice. And I've also got third-party footage. I've got guys mostly FS7 users and a few Blackmagic users from around the world have sent me, you know, 10, 15 clips of their best stuff that right. guys that use my LUTs and kind of, you know, like them. Yep. I've got some third-party footage. So I've got some incredible footage to show the LUTs on as well. Some stuff in India, Nepal, France, Paris, Scotland. I've got some absolutely stunning footage to mix in with my own. And I'm in the middle of making the video now, but the LUTs are pretty much finished. So I'll have to send you the finished ones, and so you can have an advanced kind of play with them and let me know what you think.
That'd be amazing.
I think I'm more likely to use these now instead of my Alexa one. Oh, it depends. It depends on the project. But I think I'm really happy with all 10 now. I'm really awesome. every single one of those 10 is good. And I've actually learned a few things again making these LUTs. Now I want to go and make a couple of tweaks to the Alexa LUTs. Just a couple of little things. And then I'll sort of release that update as well probably in the coming month or two. So yeah, it's become my full-time thing at the moment because
that's fantastic. No and you make all of these in DaVinci.
Yeah, I make them all in DaVinci. I started in Premiere and then very quickly reached the limit of Premiere's capabilities, and then now I'm pretty confident in Premiere. DaVinci. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I always talk about color. I love color. It's fun.
Mm.
I'm no colorist though. Mm-hmm. I'm absolutely no colorist. I'm the type of person, let me overlay an adjustment layer.
Yeah.
Put the LUT on that and go, you know, back and forth, just adjusting the exposure, making sure everything matches.
Yeah.
But I don't have the patience to go one clip at a time.
Yeah.
Adjusting skin tones, adjusting the sky, adjusting the grass. Yep. You know, I don't have that kind of patience.
Well, I'm so similar in that way, actually. I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, I've started coloring projects, actually. I've graded the last four of my own. I'm sort of going to start looking into actually doing it professionally because I'm getting pretty confident now with everything I've learned in these last couple of years. So, but I agree with you. I mean, that's part of the reason I spend so many months testing the LUTs is because ideally, if you put the LUT on, you shouldn't have a problem with skin tone. You know, we're going from outdoors, skin looks great, but we're going inside mixed lighting with tungsten. Well, I want the LUT to work there as well. I want the LUT to be, you know what I mean? So that's why I work really hard on containing all of the saturations and making sure that it's going to work no matter what you throw at it. That's something I'm pretty proud of, is that pretty much you should be able to handle anything you can throw at them, which like a real film stock should, you know, or the real Alexa can.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that, you know what, I didn't notice because I never had an issue.
Mm.
Every time I applied the LUT, I always expected it to work and it did always work.
Mm.
But I never pointed that part out because, again, it's just something that never came up. You know, I've never had an issue where these LUTs are not going to work here because it's either underexposed or overexposed or the lighting is different.
Well, that's good. The LUT should be invisible. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, the philosophy of people trusting organic processes. It's kind of like it's people tend to trust the less people tamper or the less it appears that people have tampered with something, people seem to trust that more. So even as a cinematographer, like Roger Deakins, he always talks about, you know, and I probably subscribe to this method of lighting. It should look like you haven't lit anything. It should look like, I don't want you to notice my work. If you're noticing my work, again, what's that doing? It's distracting you from the story.
It is.
So it's the same philosophy. If the look, if it looks too digital, again, let's use the infrared example. If it's infrared, that's going to distract from the story. So it's the same basic idea of, you want to hide your work. You want to hide your fingerprints because I think that's the magic of nature. Like I'm pretty sure I know you're a Christian. I'm a Christian too, so I believe in God. And I believe,
awesome.
Yeah, amen. I believe one of the magic of nature and of the universe we live in is everything works. You look around, things just work. But then you look at a leaf. You go, oh, there's a leaf. That looks like a pretty basic kind of a thing. Then you get a microscope. You look at what's going on in that leaf. It's so incredibly complex. You look at a cell, the complexity of a cell. And then the cell relies on, you know, smaller and smaller, increasingly smaller particles, and you know, and we get down
atoms.
To, you get down below atoms, and it's just energy. So it's kind of like this beautiful thing. The universe is this beautiful or elegant, insanely complex thing. But the fingerprint of God, the fingerprint of nature, is it doesn't look complex. It always looks. It just works for us. And that's what I try to put into the LUTs.
That's so good, man. That's so good.
That's my philosophy of art. It's like, I don't want you to see fantastic. Me. I'm invisible. The it's meant to just work.
I love it, man. Such a good analogy. No, you're absolutely right. Like, things like... when you dig deep inside, like, when you start paying real attention to how things are created, and that goes with anything really, you can see the complexity of it. You know, that's why people don't understand why a 1 minute video is going to cost a lot of money, because all they see is the final product.
It just flows, it just works,
but it, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah,
but that's so awesome, and I love your passion for this stuff. I think this is the deepest podcast I've ever done. This is fantastic. I'm learning so much.
That's
honestly
awesome, dude. It's, you know, I love talking about it, because again, you know, you have to remember 3-4 years ago I was like the most depressed I'd ever been. I have all these ideas and I see all this stuff, but then I was like, well, I'm gonna have to sell cars, and I was like, God, why? Literally praying, why'd you make me like this? Why'd you give me these abilities or this sensitivity, and I have nothing to do with it? So I'm so, honestly, Ariel, I could get emotional just if I really am honest about it. The way my life has gone, my life has changed so dramatically in the last 3-4 years. I've been so blessed. I've been so many doors have opened.
That's so incredible.
I mean, I think that's the secret to your original question. Let's face it. Like you said, how has this happened so quickly? I haven't been doing it alone. And I give honor and I glory to God. Honestly, dude, like, it's been insane. Amen. Think this is my calling. This is what I was put on this earth to do, to see these things and to remind the world of beauty. Like, there's something very important about just making beautiful things, because the world, I feel like, is turning on beauty. We're getting into an uglier and uglier place, and I just want to be part of. I want to be part of keeping it as beautiful as possible. Everything I do, I'm trying to keep that beauty alive. You know,
I think that, you know, I'm gonna actually even take it a step further for you. I think that, you know, we're given these opportunities, and I feel the same way. I haven't grown as fast as you have, obviously. You're at a whole nother level, but I do believe that. I mean, I never considered myself a creative. I never, before I got into video, you know, filmmaking and all the stuff that I do, I mean, I was an athlete. I was playing college football. Like, I was the complete opposite of the artistic industry, like anything like this. I was the complete opposite.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, but. So, I mean, you wouldn't see me as an ideal candidate to do what I'm doing, you know, from there. So I believe that, you know, the Lord has its purpose, and it would be a shame if we don't glorify his name with what he's gifted us with.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's,
Well, and I just think that that's what you got to do. Like, You got to figure out your private secret little thing that you're doing this for. And there are many different ways to do this. You know, I the world wouldn't work. I love producers. I love everyone I work with, because they all, like, the world wouldn't. The producers make the world go round, but typically producers don't have this sensitivity or this awareness of beauty. Sometimes they do, but they see it in us, and they empower us, and they, you know, employ us to make things, but they're coming at it from a different reason, and maybe they just want to facilitate, or directors. You know, I sort of see myself as a director at the end of the day. I'm not directing right now, because professionally I'm just building a career as a cinematographer. Maybe later I'll cross over into directing, we'll see. But
Okay, but
directors, you know, they come at it from their particular way. Editors, you know, there's all different kinds of brains and different kinds of passions. But whatever it is, you got to find that little thing, and you got to cherish it. And for me, it's just, at the end of the day, I can't tell you, dude, how gratifying it is. Just hearing you saying what you said before about LUTs, or hearing, I get emails all the time, dude, with people like saying the most amazing things. And I just choose not to be cynical about it. I choose not to be glib about it. I go, I just made that guy, yeah, I gave that guy's camera a new life because of the work that I did. Or this person was, you know, this person was about to sell their camera, you know, or help them bring their project to life, or just knowing what, that they could create these images, they went out and shot more, like they're shooting more because they like their camera more. So I had a part to play in that. I'm not going to let that slide. I'm going to hold on to that. I'm going to thank God that I could. I just put a little bit of beauty into the world. I just helped solve some problems. Like, that's a great, basic, simple thing. Just simple. Because, as you can tell, I can complicate things in the way I love complexity and talking about things in a deep philosophical level, but you also need to keep it simple sometimes. And for me, it's just that. As long as I'm helping the world a little bit with my gifts, that's it. And if I can make money doing that, like, that's a win-win for me. It's such a beautiful compromise. Like,
that's a dream.
Yeah.
To make money doing what you love to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And no, seriously, congratulations. You definitely have a great product. I don't remember a job that I've edited or anything that I've edited that I haven't used them. I think that they're my default color for everything that I do.
That's actually awesome, dude. I didn't realize you were using them. I kind of wondered. Yeah. I kind of thought you had tried them and gone, nah, not for me. So that's good to hear. I didn't actually.
No. I'm sorry, but they are my default color for everything.
Oh, cool.
Just because before I'm like, man, I don't like shooting S-Log 3 just because it's a mission to get the right color.
Mm.
It's a mission to kind of put it, you know, for like, I'm not getting paid most of the time to get too extensive with my videos. Mm. But I love the fact that it could seem like I did just because they look so good. And I love the fact that now I don't have to worry about shooting S-Log 3. I can retain my dynamic range that I love to have.
Yeah.
And still, with a simple click of a button, put that color in there.
Yeah.
And I'm good to go.
Well, that's the other thing, was the exposure. The LUTs kind of, you know, when you shoot on an Arri, everything's just, again, it's like we said, it's easy and it's natural. The Arri just works. It's easy to expose. Yeah. But then when you shoot in Sony, why does it have to be so hard? And why is I exposed? I think I exposed okay. And it's like, oh, I overexposed too much. I blew out all my highlights. At least I don't have noise. Or I underexposed. And it's like, now I've got the images destroyed by all this noise and these artifacts. And you go, what the hell? Like, why is it so tricky? So the LUTs, the idea was just to make the look of the Arri, especially with the Alexa LUTs and the film LUTs, the look of film on Arri, but also the workflow more of the Arri of just put the LUT on your monitor. If it looks good on the monitor, it's going to be fine. It's going to be clean.
Yep.
It's going to look natural, and it's going to be robust. You can take it in a mixed lighting. You can take it anywhere you want. You're not going to have to overexpose that much. Basically, you overexpose half a stop and you're good. The LUTs are designed, the gamma curve and the contrast down the bottom, it kind of gets rid of the noise, which is kind of, sometimes people think I'm lying about that, but, or they think like, how can a LUT do that? But I'm telling you, I shoot at 4000 on my FS7, like ISO, you know, 4000 recently for the most recent job I did. The director wanted to add grain, it was so clean. So 2000 ISO is fine. You know, it's just, yeah, it's meant to be, it just makes it easy. And I think that's another big part of why people are enjoying the LUTs, is it just makes it fun to shoot. It's just, you can shoot like an artist. You don't have to worry about all the technical stuff. The LUT has done that for you, you know?
No, that's fantastic. So what are your thoughts on the new Sony color science? It's been applied to the FX9.
Okay.
I also ordered the A7S III.
Yep. Saw that.
Super excited about that. What are your thoughts?
I got my hands on the FX9 actually just this past weekend. I'd been first asked. Time? Yeah. So I rented it for the weekend and I shot like 20 to 30 side-by-sides in my Amira, because I'm going to make a LUT for it, because I've had a few... my old LUTs for the FS7 don't quite work as... They work, but they're just... You have to bring the saturation down. It's a different sensor. It actually looks pretty good, to be honest. So like, if anyone's listening and you've got my LUTs, and you have an FX9, here's what you do. Go into Premiere, drop the saturation to 90, move the magenta to 8, and you'll have a pretty damn nice image. But I can't guarantee it'll still look like the Alexa. It'll just look nice. Right. So I have to actually start again from scratch. And
yeah, because your LUTs are trying to... I noticed you said move the magentas to 8. Is that because your LUTs are compensating for the correct magentas that you get in the skin tones?
Yeah, so to neutralize the original FS7, it's very magenta. The mirror is, if anything, is a slight green, but it's pretty damn neutral. The RE's color science is spot on. So, yeah, my LUTs are greener than the initial Sony LUTs, but the problem with the FX9 is it's very green. It's greener than anything, so my LUTs push it extra green. So, so I got my hands on the FX9. I shot some stuff on the weekend. I used the S709 LUT, which is the recommended LUT from Sony. Not a big fan.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
But the dynamic range was great. The noise was very little. It was very clean.
Are you talking about the S Cinetone or a different LUT?
No, I'm talking about the S-Log 3 LUT for the FX9. I think it's the Venice LUT, and that's recommended for this FX9.
Oh, I heard about that Sony provides.
Yeah, and it's the same for the A7S III. Apparently, it's the recommended LUT, but honestly, it's pretty gross. It was very green. This is the next project. Once I finish these film LUTs,
nice.
My next project is the A7S III and FX9 LUT, which I'm excited about. So
I'm excited about that because, in my recent video, I had mentioned that the A7S III, I'm expecting it to be my next default camera for all my jobs.
For sure.
There's several reasons why I decided to do that. I just think that I was trying too hard to stay in the cinema line just to, I guess, give myself the confidence of being a documentary filmmaker, and I can't do that if I'm not using the cameras that other documentary filmmakers are using.
Yeah, and perception. And perception.
Yeah, and so when I was shooting with the GH5, oh my God, I was able to be so agile. I was so versatile. I was able to crawl into any hole, get in any angle, and get the shot that I needed.
Yeah.
You know? And that is much more valuable to me than trying to have a rigged out FS7 with the Easy Rig. And, you know, I have all this stuff that it's just not necessary and that it's actually going to get in my way.
Yeah.
The moment that I need to get into like a pretzel and get a specific shot.
You know, in terms of perception, which obviously we all know is important for clients and agencies and you know, people who don't know about the gear. One thing to do is you could bring the FS7 and have it set up there, but then go, I'm just going to use this smaller camera for now, and if I need it, that one's there. And it's kind of sitting there as an ambassador of your professionalism. It's a prop. And you might need it because of the NDs or the audio, but then you shoot 95% of it on the A7S III. And
one thing that I did not mention in the video, it's funny because I mentioned the problems with the A6300, how I needed XLRs, I needed the shotgun mic, I needed the monitor and all that stuff. But I never mentioned the solution that I got.
Yeah, right.
And I'm looking at that video, I'm like, oh my God, I never, this is how you know I'm not like a YouTuber. I'm not a YouTuber. It's like, gosh, it wasn't, and it's funny because that video became quite popular. I got great responses from it.
Yeah.
But I never mentioned the solution that I get with the A7S III.
But the
fact that we have that audio unit that we can, you know, connect to the hot shoe mount.
Yeah.
That gives us now two XLR inputs. But not only that, we get a stereo mic that we can connect via 3.5 millimeter jack.
Yeah.
So I can have a shotgun microphone connected through a 3.5 millimeter jack and have two XLR inputs, which I use my Sennheisers.
Yeah.
For audio, and I have four audio tracks. Not even the FS7 gives you that.
That's crazy.
That's insane.
That's insane.
That's the stuff that I'm like, why would Sony
I know.
just do that.
Cannibalize it's, like the FX9. I think there's a lot of FX9 users I've seen complaining on the Facebook page about that, or at least debating about it. Like, what? Why buy the FX9 for that much when you can buy the A7S3? I mean, I think I'm keeping my FS7 for the foreseeable future. Like you, I think you said the same. It does it's got its perks, and let's actually talk about, you mentioned it maybe 15, 20 minutes back, you mentioned the color of the FS7. So I find now I've got the Pocket 4K, I would, if I had a passion project or a commercial project with a big budget, I'd use my mirror, okay?
Okay.
But the great thing about the Pocket is, like, if I needed a B cam, it was going to be the FS7. And it still could be, but I would go the Pocket over the FS7 for a few reasons. I do prefer the image, and we'll talk about that in a sec. I think it's not, maybe it's a sensor, but I actually think it could be the ProRes codec, but we'll come back to that. The next thing is it's smaller, obviously, so good for tight spaces, just light. Can put on a gimbal. I've got a little light steady cam as well that I can put that on. And then also the low light. So if I am, I mean, I don't see myself using this, but every one out of 100 times you might need, you know, you're in trouble, you're running out of light. It's nice to be able to bump up to 6,000 ISO and just shoot it on my Pocket and it'll match with your mirror, you know, because I've made a LUT that matches it. So it's my go-to B cam, right? But the FS7 still has a place because of, the internal NDs showing up on a job, but it's real run and gun. People know the FS7. Like you said, people like it. They trust it. Yeah. And the image is still great. Like, dynamic range is great. There's nothing to complain about. But I think it's the codec. The only problem I have with the FS7 is I think it's the processing in the image and the codec. Because when I had my FS5, and you actually mentioned this too, when I outputted my FS5 to my Shogun to ProRes, that image is honestly close to the Amira. Like,
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. Like, it's my gorgeous. If you go to my cinematography showreel, like 70% of it is still from my FS5. Like, I still have a lot of great footage on that. So when I went to the FS7, it was a step down from the FS5 RAW to ProRes. So I think it's largely the codec and the processing. The FS7 sensor's fine. It's just that codec. It does something weird to the skin. It's just a little bit, the color separation. It's a bit mushy.
You know what it is? And I think we mentioned it earlier. You could almost tell every time somebody uses an FS7.
Yeah.
Every time I see my footage and I say, that looks like FS7 footage.
I think it's a codec,
It's that thing that we mentioned earlier that it's distracting because it doesn't look natural.
No.
It's something about, and you're probably, it might be the codec that might be doing that, but you know,
the Pocket shoots ProRes, and it's something about ProRes, man.
It's just so beautiful. It's just so beautiful.
Apple nailed it, like, what, 10 years ago? Whatever.
I can't believe, like, it's so disappointing. Like, to get the FS7 or the FX9, they're still requiring the $2,500 extension unit to get the RAW. The FS5 has it in body.
It's so weird, man. It is.
It's so weird. Why would they do that? It's a way better image.
Like, I people email me all the time, like LUT users, going, "Hey, man, love you, LUTs. Just wondering. You've shot on a bunch of Sonys. What would you recommend?" I honestly say, listen, if image is your thing, go with the FS5 or the Shogun. It's the best Sony image I've ever shot.
Yes.
The skin tones are just stunning,
gorgeous.
The only problem is, and I've encountered this with my LUTs, and this is something I'm gonna have to deal with.
Yeah,
the Shogun. The only problem is that it actually cuts off like a half a stop at the top and a half a stop at the bottom. It adds contrast. The S-log curve is different from the Shogun.
I noticed it for the longest time. I'm trying to figure out, is this S-Log 2 or S-Log 3? And it's I don't think it's either. I think it's something in the middle.
Well, they say, you can't actually shoot S-Log 3. This is another thing people... See, Sony wasn't clear about this. I had to talk to Alistair Chapman about this. He knew about it because he talks directly to the Sony engineers. So he's kind of the middleman for a lot of this really technical stuff. And he was saying how essentially, yeah, the actual gamma curve. It's also more saturated. Now, that could be because it's raw. It could be because it's more contrasty, and obviously contrast tends to add saturation. I don't know, but that's the only problem, and I'm actually running into it with these film LUTs, because these film LUTs have a bit more contrast than my Alexa LUTs. When I put the film LUTs on my old FS5 to raw, you know, Shogun stuff, it's a little too crunchy, so I have to come up with like a pass-through LUT that you put on beforehand to kind of flatten the contrast a little bit, and then you can put on my film LUT. Because anytime someone shoots FS5 to ProRes on the Shogun, you're going to have slightly more contrast and saturation. Yeah. So
That's
the only problem that there is, but the image is the best. It's beautiful.
Yeah, what I ended up doing, because I haven't shot FS5, I have all of your LUTs are all installed on all my monitors, the Shogun Inferno and the Ninja V. And then specifically when I would shoot FS5 with the Shogun, it was definitely way too contrasty, and I wish I wish there was a way to kind of tone down the intensity.
Yeah.
Right on the monitor, but I can't do that. So what I did So what I did was, I mean, I shot a little bit. I took that same footage. I dropped on your LUT, and again, it was the same, way too contrasty, because obviously it's not built for that image. I tweaked it myself just a little bit, just took off some contrast and lowered the intensity, and to a place where I kind of liked it, and I now use that as my a point of reference for exposure. You know, and
were you shooting SLOG 3 by any chance?
Well, remember, I was shooting externally.
Were you putting the SLOG 3 LUT on though, or
SLOG I was putting the SLOG 3 LUT.
There you go. That's the problem.
And yeah, it got
so me. here's the thing. It's just a little technical thing, anyone listening. Again, I learned this through Alistair Chapman. So no matter what you do on the FS5, you can select SLOG 3. Guess what? It's the Shogun takes the raw code. It encodes it as SLOG 2. So it doesn't matter what you do on the FS5. Well, it does. The color space will come through. So be aware of that. So I used to shoot SLOG 2 S-Gamut 3 Cine, which is the SLOG 3 color space, on my FS5 RAW. It looked great, but there was more noise. Alistair taught me that. Appreciate that. We had a bunch of conversations about all this maybe a year or two back. Anyway, so he said he did some tests, and he said it's recommended to shoot SLOG 2 S-Gamut, the original SLOG 2 on FS5 when you're outputting to the Shogun. So yeah, definitely. I actually have that in the readme, the LUTs, for those who shoot on the Shogun. Always do it. Send out PP7 default and you'll get the best image, and then use my SLOG 2 LUTs as well. And then that should help. The contrast should be okay with the Alexa LUTs because they're nice and gentle. But it still will be a little bit crunchy. So yeah.
Do you know if the FS5 Mark II, I know it's a different color science from the Mark I.
Apparently only, not SLOG 2, apparently the sensor's the same. It's just they have a picture profile which matches the Venice, which I think is no picture profile. If you don't put any picture profile on, it's like you get a Venice look. But apparently SLOG 2 is the exact same. SLOG 3, everything's the same in terms of the actual S-Gamut and all that stuff.
That's interesting. I mean,
but Sony needs to communicate this stuff better.
Yeah,
that's the other reason I made the LUTs. Like, you know, so many Sony shooters don't know all this stuff, and it's like I had to research for a long time to learn all this, and I had to talk to Alistair, who seems to know it all. But most guys don't. Most guys don't know, because he just asked the Sony engineers. He goes, "Oh, I spoke to them the other day. They said this," and I'm like, "Why don't they make this public? I don't get it. Are they too lazy? Is it just like they'll figure it out?"
What do you think? What do you think that the 16-bit RAW from the A7S3 is going to look like?
Oh man, that's pretty cool. to be honest, though, I never shoot RAW. Like,
yeah,
I'm happy with ProRes.
No, absolutely. But to be able to take that 16-bit,
it's amazing,
and
it's
put
amazing.
It into ProRes,
it's bizarre.
It's going to be. Yeah, I hope
it's bizarre that FX9 doesn't do it.
I mean, I hope that Atomos just gives the Ninja V a firmware update, but I think they're going to come out with another monitor.
They'd be insane not to, because I have a feeling, like I said to you the other day, this is going to be the highest selling camera of all time. Like, the buzz on this is insane.
This is the first I've never pre-ordered anything in my life.
Me neither. Me neither. Ever. I always buy secondhand, yeah. I've never bought anything new.
Never, never. I think that I might... I'm already thinking I might get a second one, but I don't mind buying that one used later. Yeah. But I was just too excited for this camera. They just gave us everything.
Yeah. It's crazy, man.
Everything. It's... Like, forget the fact that they have better. I mean, not better. Not even better. It's just forget the fact that they have the FX9 that came out, what, less than a year ago?
Yeah.
The Venice? None of those cameras offer even what the A7S III is offering. In terms of recording formats.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think the Venice does, but I think you have to upgrade it and buy modules and buy licenses and stuff.
Dude, you're gonna have to spend a lot of money. What does the Venice go for?
I was literally talking to someone yesterday about this. I think they're $50,000 US around 40, like an Alexa Mini. Yeah.
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah, man. I'll tell you though, man. It's getting to the point now. Shooting on my pocket, there is definitely the Amira still has a better image than anything I've got, but it is pretty good, that little pocket. Like, and you know, with the A7S III, again, I'm a little worried about those codecs, but it seems like they've got super high bit rates with those extra Sony codecs. So let's hope, fingers crossed, the Sony codec doesn't ruin, you know, but that's a good thing. You can output RAW, so that solves that problem. If you don't like the Sony codec,
yeah,
you can output RAW.
So I'm excited. It's kind of I'm excited for that amazing. RAW because, you know, you're going to be able to, for higher end projects, just rig out the camera, bust out the monitor, and you don't have to worry about impressing clients, because I think that that's going to do it.
And it can do everything. I mean, it's small. The new batteries are way better, like the A7 III batteries. I had an A7 III for about a year. I love those new batteries. It was such an improvement. Yep. So, you know, that's the thing with the Pocket 4K. It's got crappy batteries. So the A7 III S3 has... I mean, the things that I'm excited about, I'm not a huge... I don't shoot 120p a lot, so I don't care about it like crap.
Right.
Like, everyone seems to get so excited about that. But it's good to have the option, but right. I don't tend to do it. I love the rolling shutter improvement. That's what I care about.
That is things good. Like that,
when you go handheld and you're getting those
driving shots.
Yeah, driving. Because everyone always thinks about fast pans. It bothers me the most when you're going handheld and your camera's like getting shaky, and then all of a sudden the image turns into jelly. That's what bothers me about rolling shutter.
Okay.
So that's what's great about the Amira. It just has no rolling shutter. So you can get really rough and it looks like film again. That's what film looks like. It just doesn't ever fall apart. So A7S III's got that. It's got obviously crazy low light, full frame if you want it, Super 35 if you want it. It's got everything. It's, you know, and if you get a matte box and NDs or even just a nice variable ND, I mean, you're good to go. It's just...
Yeah. I mean, that's the plan for me. I am going to miss the internal ND. I'm willing to sacrifice it to have a camera that could basically do everything I need it to do.
And you know the crazy thing, dude? I've been testing the Pocket 4K because it's got dual ISO. So I can put on a plus four ND in my matte box, right? So it's taking four stops of light out. Put that on the pocket and I can shoot in broad daylight. And then if I go indoors, I can just crank it up to 5,000 ISO, the next ISO. It's pretty damn clean and I don't have to take the ND off if I'm desperately running around.
Yeah,
So I imagine the A7S III could be the same, where if you really want a high quality
That ND, low light, you know, is incredible. Yeah. Is incredible.
And apparently it's got a second... I don't know if you've seen this, but they reckon there's a dual ISO in it at 16,000.
16,000 from, what is it, 12,800?
Yeah, it gets really clean again. So
that's so weird.
Imagine having 16,000 ISO. That's so bright. Like, you could put an ND on it, like I said, and just shoot in a dark room inside it with an ND on.
Oh, man. I think that Sony claims that that's not a dual ISO thing. But they asked Sony. All the YouTubers are pointing it out. Gerald Undone pointed it out. But Sony says, no, we didn't put dual ISO in this camera. But they still don't explain why that's happening.
It looks exactly like it.
It does. Everybody's like, guys, this is dual ISO. It's like, do you even know what you guys are doing? It's super, super interesting. We don't know. I mean, Sony just hasn't explained what's going on there, because I think that's something that would have been a highlight feature. But I don't think, I mean, I don't think a camera like that needs dual ISO.
No, I mean, it's absolutely insane.
It's crazy.
But I guess to answer your first question, actually, the color science, I haven't been amazed so far, but I'm not worried because I know that I can fix it. I know that there's enough going on with the sensor that I can tweak it and get it the way I like it anyway.
I think that the video that really convinced me about that was Potato Jet. He's showing side-by-side comparison of what I consider FS5 footage. I think he had the A6400 or something like that. But it's all the same footage to me. And he's showing like the footage that I'm super used to already looking at. The magentas and the skin tones, the navy blue that becomes magenta, like it's just disgusting. And you know, he's putting it side by side with this camera, and everything is just so natural to the eye.
So but here's a question: was that S log or was that just no profile? Like, what was it? Do you know?
That's a great question. Yeah. I want to assume it's either S log 2 or 3.
Because here's the thing, there's a big difference with the new LUT. Like, so the new Sony LUT S709, I think it's probably an improvement from the old Sony look, but it's too far the other way now. So it used to be magenta, now it's too green. Like, I can show you when I released the LUT for the FX9, there's some footage I shot of my wife, and the Sony LUT looks like a gremlin. Like, she looks green. So I still don't think anyone's beaten Ari. I expected they would. I thought, oh, one day everyone's going to catch up. But to my shock, when I look at the Blackmagic Pocket LUT, I'm like, I don't know why no one knows how to make a decent LUT except for Ari. Like, Ari just has the best 709 LUT to date, in my opinion. And I guess it's for me, it's not the end of the world, though, because I get to make these LUTs and, you know, it works out for me. But
I'm looking at the video now. I'm looking at the comparisons. Dude, this is S-Log 3 comparing the Sony A6600, the camera that I have, with the Sony A7S III. Both of them are in S-Log 3. Both of them are in S-Gamut 3 Cine with the LUT applied.
Yep.
The greens look way more natural. There's just no magenta. Everything. Yep. But I don't know if it's just this picture, because there's a lot of green here. They're in the forest. But I don't know if it's looking... But it looks incredible.
Well, maybe, yeah. I'll tell you this much. I definitely know that when I make a LUT that I'm happy with, I know it's going to be a step up from the other cameras, because just, you know, the processing, the codec probably is better. There's less noise, more dynamic range. All those things, the raw data that the sensor is giving you is just going to give you that much extra ability to make it get a nicer image. Whether or not I like the particular LUT is kind of irrelevant, because you can always tweak LUTs and change them and, you know, redesign them. But yeah, what the sensor's going to be giving, I'm excited about for sure. Like, and that it will be updated. It will be better, I think. Like the FX9, the footage, I've had guys sending me footage because they're like, can you make a LUT for this? And they've sent me footage, and just putting my LUT on it and tweaking it a bit, it does look better than the FS7, no doubt about it. Like, it looks, So the potential in these new cameras, I think, is there. Just for some reason, I think the Sony LUTs are a little off to me.
Yeah.
But I would say they're an improvement from that old magenta Sony look for
sure. You're referring to like the LUTs that Sony is providing themselves, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Which, you know, that's what everyone's using pretty much right now, because it's early days. And that's what everyone... I mean, that is the official Sony color science. That is the official Sony LUT.
Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, from what I'm seeing, and again, I'm comparing it. It's not hard to make any other camera look better than the A6600 or any of these other Sony camera image. But I'm looking at it now. It's a
it does look good. I'm looking at it too.
Dramatic improvement.
It looks better than the FX9, actually.
Are you looking at it right now?
Looking at, yeah, I think, is it Sony Camera Showdown? Is that what you're looking at?
No, I'm looking at Potato Jet's video. A7S3.
Meet my new favorite mirrorless.
Exactly.
Camera,
and
one?
go to 9:30.
Okay. 9:30. Here we go.
You see him with a tent right there?
Yep. Yeah, you know, you're spot on. I mean, it definitely looks more neutral.
It's incredible.
Which is what you want.
It's insane. Yeah. And then the first one I saw, go to 50 seconds. 50 seconds. And you'll see, or 47 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
You can see that comparison right there.
So I would argue that because of everyone's hatred for the old magenta look, we've been putting up with that for so long. Yeah. to see just the magenta corrected, is already like, you know, refreshing and sight for sore eyes. But I don't know. It kind of does look like the FX9. And again, when I show you that lot next to the Amira, I think you'd have the same reaction again. Like, you know what I mean?
No, I mean,
like,
look, anything. First of all, I can already see the 8-bit color on the A6600 breaking down. I can see it in his left arm.
Totally.
It's already breaking down. So the 10-bit space that we're going to have is fantastic. And I'm excited to just test out LUTs. Even whatever LUTs you make, it's just going to be a huge, drastic improvement. Anything that we create, we're going to have that space to work with, you know? That's what I'm excited about mostly, you know?
It's nice that they're cleaner too, because Sony is, they've always recommended overexposing, which when I first got into Sony, I'm like, what the hell? Why did they make a camera that you couldn't expose properly? Why, you know, how is that a finished product? Like I have to, if I expose it normally, it's swimming with noise. It's like, that doesn't seem like it's the way it should be. So it's nice that these new cameras, they're like, you don't have to overexpose them. They're clean, just shoot. Nice and easy. So that's already a huge improvement.
It's huge.
Well,
man, we can continue to go on and on and on about these cameras and the color science just because it's so much fun.
Yeah, man. We should do this again sometime.
Absolutely.
It was good to finally talk to you.
Where can people find all of your stuff, your work? I'm going to be putting links down below, obviously, but where can they go if they want to go direct?
Yeah. Just to my website. So it's joelfamularo.com. And you can see the LUTs there. If you go to the color, go into the color menu, and that's where the LUTs are if you want to look at them. And you can see my work there as well on the film menu. And a little bit about me, all that sort of stuff. And then you can find my Vimeo page if you just search my name, and Instagram, if you'd like to follow me and keep up to date.
Awesome. Dude, thank you so much for coming on the show. We had, like I said before, this was the deepest conversation I've had on the show to date. So it was awesome. It was very refreshing. Very refreshing brother in Christ. And just thanks so much for coming in and sharing your passion with my audience. I'm sure they definitely appreciate it.
My pleasure, dude. I really appreciate you inviting me on, and look forward to working on stuff together in the future and staying in touch, and hope you like the new LUTs. I'll send you over the advanced copies.
Perfect.
And I'd love to hear your thoughts, actually. It'd be great to get your feedback.
Yes. Awesome. Thanks for coming on, man.
No worries, man. Thank you.
So there is my conversation with Joel Famularo. As you can see, we got pretty deep on this one, and I definitely want to say one more time thank you to Joel for sharing his passion with us. As you can see, there's a lot of passion to be had in this industry, and as I mentioned earlier in this episode, without passion, you're just chasing, to make money, and truth be told, the beginning of your career, of any creative career, in my opinion, is not going to be that glamorous. There's going to be a lot of grind, but that passion is going to drive you. And that is very important to have that passion for that exact reason. So I hope you found this episode helpful for you guys. As I mentioned, I'll have links to everything we spoke about on the show notes for this episode. And just look down below. You'll see all the links there and Joel's information. You can go to his website, find his Phantom LUTs. I'm going to have a separate link for his Phantom LUTs right in the description for this episode. You could also use coupon code Ariel. That's my name, R-I-E-L. And get a nice little discount when you go to check out. And it helps support the podcast as well. So it's a win-win. So thank you guys once again for watching this episode. If you found it helpful at all, and I think you should have, share this with a friend. Send this to somebody. Leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. We definitely appreciate that. It helps us with the rankings. And just thanks so much for your support and continuing to listen to this podcast. Please drop me a line. I'm on Instagram and Twitter. On Instagram is at Ariel Martinez Films. And make sure you just send me a message. Let me know your thoughts. You could also find the podcast Instagram over at iFilmmaker Podcast. Drop us a line there as well. So thanks for listening, and I will catch you on the next episode of the iFilmmaker Podcast.